I was born in a small town called Masjid Suleiman in southern Iran.
I was born in Syria.
I was born in Hamburg, Germany.
I was born in Kuwait.
I was born in Tanzania in a refugee camp.
I was born in Singapore.
Guatemala. I'm from Ireland.
I was born in Thailand, refugee
camp. I was born in Mumbai.
I was born in Vientiane, Laos.
I was born in England.
I was born in Costa Rica.
Welcome to Many Roads in Conversation. In this series, we find experts in their fields to sit down together and talk. They discuss issues facing immigrant, refugee, and first-generation communities already residing in the U.S. I'm your host, Caitlin Dwyer. In conversation today are two remarkable women, both public servants. Siporn Ching is the director of Business Oregon, the economic development agency for the state of Oregon. Tak Sonalai Gillespie is the director of the Office of Immigrant and Refugee Advancement for the state. They've worked together throughout their careers, and the relationship is one of friendship and mutual respect. They spoke at the end of 2023 about what it feels like to finally be inside the halls of power with an opportunity to make a difference. Together, they reflected on the promises and struggles of serving in government, got real about how immigration policy has advanced and stalled, and wondered how to involve the community in public policy.
Good morning, Tak. How are you?
Sabaidi, Saporn. Good morning. I'm good. What about you?
I'm doing good. It's so good to see you. Let me just introduce myself real quick, and I would love you to tell all of us a little bit about yourself. So my name is Saporn Ching. My pronoun she, her. I'm a Cambodian-American. I was born and raised in Cambodia, and I came here about 23 years ago. It's an honor and privilege right now to serve as the Director of Business Oregon in the state government. I understand that you are also now in the state government as well. So let's talk a little bit about that later. Well, why don't you tell us a little bit about yourself?
I will say, I know you are introducing yourself for like the audience that may not know you, but I love hearing you introduce yourself, not just because you pronounce your last name so beautifully, but just, again, continue to hear how you speak about you and the work that you do. Thank you. Tak Sonalai Gillespie. My pronouns are she, her, and Sal. I get the privilege to serve as the director of the Office of Immigrant and Refugee Advancement. For those who don't know, I like to think it's a brand new office. It was established in the 2021 session, thanks to Senator Casey Jama and countless community partners who advocated for this office.
Thank you, Tak. When did you come here?
So I arrived here with mom and dad in 1979, shortly after the secret war in Laos, which some know as the Vietnam War. But before I go on, Saporn, I'm so sorry. More important than my name, I always want to make sure that folks know that I am part of a lineage and that I'm the daughter of Puvong and Sulidit. So forgive me for not mentioning that. That is so important and also something that helps to ground me, especially as we're talking about my journey and what brought me to this work.
And when you say here in Oregon?
No, we actually resettled in New York. We were one of the, you know, less than 1% that made it out of a refugee camp. And when we got to the U.S., we quickly found out that we had family in Salt Lake City, Utah. So we migrated to Utah, and then we found out we had more family in Idaho. So then we moved to Idaho, stayed there for a year. And then we found out about this place that oftentimes Lao people refer to as heaven, which was Fresno, California. For those who know Fresno, probably would not consider it heaven, but for the Lao community at the time, it was considered heaven because of the vegetation, the weather, and there were so many Southeast Asians who lived there. So it felt very familiar. So we actually lived there for 10 years, survived Fresno for 10 years. And the reason why I say that is because, you know, we lived in the projects back then. That's what it was called, low-income housing. We were on public assistance. My parents were working in the fields. And then I think what really transformed so much for me and to get a better understanding of America was when we moved to Alaska. We lived there for 10 years. So as you can see, my journey in America has gone through different states. And the reason why I share that is because I think it's important to know, like, how many different places we went to finally find a place that we can actually settle.
I'm an immigrant. I'm blessed, and I feel that I had some privilege come along with it, because when I was born right after the war in Cambodia, my parents had a dream, wanted to send me to United States. And so my journey came to United States as a student was different. Even though there's some struggle with finance, with some other living situation, but I'm sure it's not the same. And thank you for honoring and sharing the journey and with your parents. What was that journey look like when settled as a refugee family in the United States, like right after the war?
I was having to be my parents' interpreter at the time. And I remember this is when I was 9. My mother had a doctor's appointment. So it was the 3 of us, mom, dad, and me. We were waiting in the waiting room. And about 5 or so minutes before my mom's appointment, an interpreter or the receptionist came and said that we'd have to reschedule the appointment because the interpreter wasn't available. So as my parents and I were getting up to leave, I remember this white man in the waiting room. He stands up and he says, "That's right. Go home. Go back to your country." And again, at 9 years old, I'm like, okay, whatever. Yeah, we're leaving. Like, that didn't really matter to me. That comment didn't make sense. But it was what my dad said to me that has stuck with me, and something that I go back to so often now that I'm much older. He says to me, "Ani men patet kao, hao ni bin kong tim, ya lum jak tua." Translation of that, right, is this is their country. We are a throwaway. Never forget that. Again, at 9, didn't really sit with me until I got older that I said, oh my gosh, I'm not a part of this country. My parents don't feel a part of this country. It really has helped to shape how I think about belonging, adjustment, acculturation, and just how I move about in this country. As I got older, I started to see other children, other immigrant and refugee children, having to step into that role of being an interpreter and helping their parents and their family members navigate the system. And I didn't feel alone. I started to see that this was actually more common, and it gave me a little bit more strength to better understand that, again, I'm not alone. And it wasn't until I got done with grad school that I realized that this is in some ways my purpose, right, of working in this field and being an advocate for immigrants and refugees.
I mean, as an immigrant, we have a choice. Right? But then as a refugee, they don't have a choice to go back to the country. They don't have a country to go back. And I'm sure that your story, that many people can relate to that.
You mentioned the word choice. I had to learn this quite a while later as well, this word about choice. And I think a lot of the narrative is one group has a choice and the other group doesn't. I like to think that both groups don't have a choice, right? You talk about arriving as an immigrant. Refugee is a subset of the larger term, the larger, right, of immigrant. I think policies really pit us against each other. Again, I learned that in my role when I got the opportunity to serve as the director of refugee resettlement at Catholic Charities here in Oregon, that there are certain policies that essentially say one group is more worthy than the other. If you arrived through the federal Department of State, U.S. Refugee Assistance Program, then you can't go back to your country, which is true. And then there are immigrants who are arriving from the northern and southern border, immigrants who are arriving to the U.S. who are seeking refuge, right, who are seeking safety and protection through the asylum process. They, too, don't have a choice, right? If you arrive as a refugee under that status, you are on the path to citizenship. If that's a choice you want, you can work right away. You know this, right? You have all of your documents. But if you're arriving seeking safety and protection through the asylum process, you can stay in the U.S., but you're not able to access federal benefits, right? So I think when you look at it at that very basic level, again, policy really determines a lot of people's trajectory.
You got appointed by Governor Kate Brown, our former governor, as the director of Immigrants and Refugee Advancement Office. This is the first time in that office, the first position. What have you done before you get into this role?
Prior to this role, I served as the director of community health at HealthShare for, I believe, like a year. Prior to that, I was at Care Oregon Health Plan for about 4 years. And then prior to that, I think I mentioned earlier, I was the director of refugee resettlement at Catholic Charities of Oregon.
Your role that serving as the director of Immigrant and Refugee Advancement Office right now is so important because you bring in that lived experience. There's many decisions being made, state, local, or federal level, by the people who assume that 30 days enough, 90 days enough, people are going to make the money to pay back their airline ticket. That would be okay, right? And our refugees, family, don't know better because the access to the new system, they believe who they can trust. So I also believe that doors are very important. They play an important role.
When people ask me, what is your vision for this office? I actually pause and say, I don't get to determine that, right? I get to determine that in partnership with community. And in order to do that, I have to continue to work with community, both lowercase c and capital C. I'm not just talking about our immigrant and refugee community, but all those who are in this fight, right? So I think those are things that I think people need to hear and take a moment to pause and think about what it actually takes to invest in a human who is new to state government or is new to any type of work, right? And it's about relationship building. You talked about my lived experience. I think I brought to this space my earned trust. My lived experience, absolutely. But it's the earned trust that I've had from community-based organizations or immigrant and refugee communities that brought me here. That's what's helping me do my job, helping guide me. And I have to now earn trust from our state partners, our elected officials. That's an area that's really new to me, right? I'm asking for grace every day as I'm learning.
Let's just say talk about the system for a little bit here. What has changed?
Gosh, there's so many angles with this question. Oh my. First and foremost, I feel like there is a lot that has changed, particularly when we look at the immigrant and refugee system. And I'm talking specifically about refugee resettlement. And even the policies around immigration, right? The refugee resettlement system, to me, having worked in it and having arrived through that system, not much has changed, right, in the infrastructure. The refugee resettlement program is a federal program, and that federal program partners with national refugee resettlement agencies, who then partner with local agencies in various states. And those agencies are required by the federal government to make sure that a family or an individual before they arrive has housing secured. They also have to make sure that that apartment, that home, is fully furnished. They also have to pick the family up at the airport, make sure that the family has culturally specific meal upon arrival, They get a little bit of funding, what they call welcome money. They have to enroll them into healthcare, education, and all the other services such as TANF, Temporary Assistance for Needy Families, or SNAP, Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program, provide cultural orientation about the United States of America, right? Learn English, get ready to get a job. Like those core services that's required by the federal government, the requirement is that you have 30 days to do all of that, to acclimate somebody to the United States. The federal government says if you need more than 30 days, you can get up to 90. That's what I mean when I say not much has changed. Am I grateful for that system that I arrived in? Absolutely. I am not only grateful, but I feel blessed. You may have heard me say earlier, I'm part of that 1%. Research shows that less than 1% of those who are displaced actually get resettled to, you know, another country. So I am grateful for that system. And it's still the same core services. Have we expanded it to different groups? Yes and no. This is where I want to go back to policy again. Our policies decide who is more worthy than the other. And I struggle with that. The community fought for healthier Oregon program, right? I think you were a part of that as well, to ensure that folks had the basics, right? Which is Medicaid, healthcare, regardless of immigration status, as long as you meet the income guidelines. That was expanded on July
1, 2023.
It's like we stood on the mountain and like just screamed it out to everybody, particularly for our migrants who are arriving from the northern and southern border and who are arriving to seek asylum. It was so, what an amazing thing that the Oregon legislature and advocates, you know, fought for and got it passed. Because before Healthier Oregon, we had Cover All Kids, which was for folks who were 0 to 25 years old. And then Healthier Oregon was 55 and older. And there was this middle gap of those who were 26 and 54. So if you arrived and didn't have, again, the appropriate, if you will, and I'm putting quotes, immigration status, you fell in that gap and you didn't get full Medicaid, right? And as of July 1, we got that. So how do you build on that? How do you make sure that our coordinated care organizations are paying attention to this new group of folks who are now part of their membership, who are now part of their population of ensuring improved health outcomes, right? So that's just one really dynamic example of how practice informs policy, as opposed to policy informing practice. I made a really poor assumption coming into this role that my state colleagues and our elected officials actually know what I'm talking about when I say refugee resettlement or when I say those who arrive under the refugee status. Here's why I say that, because I've been asked questions like, how are they finding out about Oregon?
Mm-hmm.
Who's giving them permission to come to Oregon?
Refugee Why is Settlement 101?
Correct. So instead of being confused, for me, I was like, that's an opportunity.
Mm-hmm.
And a really big aha moment for me, and said, even though they are electeds, even though they have these fancy titles, this is an area that they might not know about and are excited to learn. That I see as like opportunities for this office to really help provide awareness and put a face to our community.
I call it as a courageous question for those elected who are willing to ask, because to your point, it is an opportunity. It's an opportunity that for them to learn, but then also an opportunity for you to advocate and being able to open their mind, really to understand those, because those who are willing to ask the question,
uh-huh.
that's mean to me, it's like those who are willing to learn.
But it's not easy though, right?
No,
like
it's
even
not.
Though we appreciate the opportunity, it's so hard. Because the moment we say immigrants and refugees, it becomes like politicized, right? And it's hard to put a face to the people, right? When we say immigrants and refugees, it's like, okay, we put them in this bucket. And then I say our newest Oregonians who are coming from all over the world. It's like, I don't know, I've been kind of playing with words, right? And how it lands for folks. So it's tough. Like the moment I walk into a room and share my title and I'm with this office, it can go either way. There are so many people fighting, right? Like I said to you earlier, like you do just as much fighting as I do for immigrants and refugees. You just do it in a different arena, right? We all do our part. And I think that's the piece that, you know, people say things like, it's what keeps me up at night. Actually, this is what gets me up, fired up in the morning. You know, I don't have a problem with sleep. I mean, I get my 8 hours of sleep, but it's like what I wake up to because I know there are so many people fighting and have fought. You and I would not be here. Remember I talked to you a while back when we found out that it was our Black civil rights leaders.
Yeah, we talk about that.
Who went to Congress, right, and fought for humans in Southeast Asia after the secret war in Laos, right, to come to the U.S. They didn't know who we were, and yet they wrote a letter to Congress and encouraged Congress, fought for us to come here. They didn't even know who we were. Like, when I think back about that, I'm like, oh, my gosh, people have been fighting for us for years. That's another piece that I think about when I think about ancestors and what gives me strength, what gives me optimism, and why I see that there's so many opportunities. We can't get stuck on why things aren't great. It's like looking back, but also looking currently at what folks are doing in so many different ways to fight for immigrant and refugee rights.
And as a director of the office, I know that you're still building, shaping the visions and also the policy. But there's so much work that's already been done here, not just in the state level. I know that you have been very active on the federal level as well. I haven't really heard lately. I would love to hear, like, what has been going on in the White House, you know? I know you've been in a call with the White House.
Look at you throwing out White House.
I'm not throwing out White House. It's a fact, right?
It is a fact. And, like, just saying it out loud, I'm like, oh, my God, I can't believe that's a part of my, like, conversations on the day-to-day. So that in itself is pretty mind-blowing that I get to sit in a room with folks at that very high level. Pretty profound. And I cannot be a seat warmer. I don't go to those meetings just to sit and, you know, listen and soak in. I was leading the language access work group. It was that moment. Not that I'm here, but, like, why am I here? And our families did not sacrifice, right, for us to sit here and relish in the title. But what is our purpose? And that's what helps me also stay grounded. Again, I don't think you and I or many of the folks who are in spaces like this take it for granted. We can't, right? Title VI of the Civil Rights Act of 1964. Here I go. It's the Discrimination Act, right? It essentially says that any entity that receives federal support has to provide access. And you can't discriminate based on race, right? Ethnicity, national origin. What happened was Executive Order 13166 was also introduced to include language. So again, any organization that receives federal support cannot discriminate. Let's make it more strength-based, right? Has to provide meaningful language access free of charge, a professionally trained interpreter, right? So that folks understand what they're accessing, but also just to communicate, right? It is a right for every person who needs an interpreter to have one, especially if they're engaging with state, federal, or organizations that receive federal support. So when we were at the White House, we were talking to our federal partners about, you know, how do we ensure that there's funding under Title VI? Because right now it's an unfunded mandate, right? Because it's the responsibility of organizations to pay for professionally trained interpreters on their own. The other thing we talked to the White House about in that particular work group was it currently is a complaint-driven type of policy, right? It's not proactive. So how do we work with federal government to really enforce the Title VI so that everybody has access to information?
And that's include American Sign Language, too.
Absolutely,
right?
Yes. Thank you for mentioning that. In fact, our office has a training on unpacking equity through a language access lens. And much of that curriculum was actually designed in partnership with our American Sign Language colleagues. It is my job to make sure that I have enough information from community to elevate up at that level. And that's what my office is doing, right? We don't get to come up with language access policies without talking to community, but also talking to like the city of Portland, mm-hmm. right? And other folks who are already doing the work. We don't need to reinvent. One of the other things that get me excited, as you know, I get excited about a lot of things, is doing a mapping of what work has already been done, whether it's around language access, whether it's around migration, and then really taking that to the conversations at the federal level.
I was just talking to a colleague the other day about how much I appreciate serving and the experience in a nonprofit because it taught me so much. Remember all of those times that we spent the night and the weekend and also running in those high heel shoes that you're still wearing right now? It's like, but the that direct impact, so different, right? A little over 5 years ago when I left ERCO, the Immigrant and Refugee Community Organization, and to join Governor Kate Brown in her administration to serve for her during that time as the Director of Diversity, Equity, and Inclusion, because her goal was really wanted to uplift the community voice.
I know you are so humble. I'm going to respectfully interrupt you. Like, the fact that you just said, like, working for, you know, Governor Kate Brown, like, that just came out of your mouth. Like, wild, right? Like, you were appointed by former Governor Kate Brown.
I still value and feel that it's the opportunity and a privilege that we have that opportunity that's been offered to us, right? You know, like when we were in a nonprofit and we done so many advocacy work, I felt like we were outside the building. And this like four, like tall, fancy building. And we keep looking from the outside. It's like, how are we going to get into that building? Because there's something in that building that we really need to see. And we're trying to get in and get in. And
you're talking about the Capitol.
Yeah, the Capitol. Mm-hmm. And then also just this, I don't know, I always see it as a system for the state government as a building. We work with the city. We work with the county, Multnomah County, City of Portland, because I mean, we're the organizations around in that location. And you know that majority of our immigrants and refugees' family reside in the dry counties, right? But yet looking from the outside, always wanted to know what it is to go inside. Then when we got to the state government, it took us a little while. I mean, at least it took me a little while.
It's still taking me a while.
We had an opportunity to change the system. Looking out, now that get into the building, we get to see that there's an opportunity. There's an opportunity that we can actually not only open the door for other people to walk into those buildings, but how can we hold those doors? And then when we actually have to leave, can we pass it on to somebody else that can still hold that door?
We have to.
Right? Then it's like, how do we continue to uplift people and then work together in partnership?
And I think there's something that has to be said about it can't just be you and me, right? We have to institutionalize this. It can't be, one of my mentors shared with, I have many mentors, you and I, but one of them, Dr. Karen Ferguson, said to me, who's now a dear friend, she said this to me when I was much younger, I was in my early years of grad school. She said, if you're the only one that can do this training, the language access training, then that means the curriculum's not good enough. I was like, excuse me? I was like, of course I'm the only one that could do this because I have the lived experience. I've been interpreting for my parents and my community ever since I was nine, right? I bring in all sorts of different examples. And then it wasn't until I got older and graduated from grad school even that I understood what she was talking about. I had to come into my own, right, to understand that that was a learning opportunity to say, if you're the only one that can do it, then that means the system you have just isn't good enough. You have to design a system where, and a process where somebody else could come in, add their flair, add their creativity to it, and it can last beyond you.
So, you know how we've been like procrastinated not to get our passport for our kids renew. And my mom keep reminding. And then they say, okay, fine. Well, we'll get it done during the holidays because it has to be appointment.
Mm-hmm.
You have to make the appointment. You have to find the location. We went to Clackamas County Records Office or passport place yesterday. We went there early because we want to make sure that we're on time, we're not missing our appointment, right? My husband, both parents need to show up. We did two last appointments, 2:15 and 2:30. Their cutoff is 2:45. They done for the day because, and I took the last two appointments for the afternoon. This family walk in, they are Hispanic family, Latino. I don't know where exactly they're coming from. But so they walk in with two young children and the parents knock on the door. Oh. One of the employees went out and say that, do you have an appointment? And they say like, no, we don't have the appointment, but we just want to check in. Then she said that, oh, here's like the place that where you're going to go and make the appointment, go to this website, make the appointment and come back later and make sure that you bring a check or a money order. The father said something. At first, I didn't really hear, but it was through a 9-year-old. Mm. I think it's like he probably about nine, the oldest one about nine. He's a little smaller than Edison. So 9 or 10 year old. He said, oh, yes, something in a car. And so she went inside and they were talking and they're like, oh, we should just let them in, right? Mm. They were just talking among like a few of them. And then they, and then the gentleman who helped us, I think he's also an immigrant himself. I think he's probably from India. But he said, I'm almost done. I mean, they have everything that they have here, this family. So I'm almost done. And he's still processing our paperwork. I can take them. And we should take them. Mm. And then they're still debating because they wanted to go through a proper.
Mm-hmm.
Then the lady, she said, yeah, I think we should just take them. I'm just like, I don't want to send them back. And then they have to make the appointment. They talk a little bit. It's like, we'll just take you. We're like, no, we are a little bit early. We'll just take you. Come on in. If you have all the paperwork. They didn't fill out the paperwork yet. She helped walk them through all that moment. And I said it out loud. Just like, I just wanted to recognize and say thank you to all of you for allowing that family to just come in rather than send them back. And sorry, it's a long story, but I wanted to highlight and tell that story. And I said, thank you, all of you, so much for making that happen for the family. That moment right there, it showed that it just only take a yes from one person.
Uh-huh.
It take only a yes from one person to change the system to allow that accessibility. And that family right now, can you imagine if they go back?
Oh, yeah.
They would not even find a website. They have to make appointment. They have to make a trip to come back again for the next day. Who knows when it's going to happen again? I'm just so inspired. I just wanted to share.
I know you were choking up.
So,
because this does hit home, right?
Mm-hmm.
So what you witness and experience is what I call, you know, kindness, grace, and flexibility that the system showed.
Yeah.
Right? And when we talk about systems, as humans work in those systems. So it helps to shape how people who are accessing services see the system. It's moments like that can really help earn trust from communities that have been harmed by systems, right? So that's that side of my brain. And there's the other side of my brain that's like, I could just feel like leadership in organizations like that, that could say, did we follow protocol? You know, we didn't stay consistent in our process, right? I don't have an answer for you, but I'm torn, just like you, like as we navigate the world, living in both worlds, right? The East and the West, I call it, right? Mm-hmm. Smack in the middle. I think that human connection is what really will help. You know, I use the word transform quite a bit, but it will. We might not see it now, but we will see it eventually. How we extend an arm, right?
Yeah.
To people who you know may have challenges, when you extend an arm to reduce some of those barriers. Don't ever apologize for taking long to share a story. I think that's the thing. I don't see very many people in state government in meetings embracing and making space for storytelling and narrative communication. When we think of when we think of white oppressive practices, it is time, right? It is racing against time, making sure that we have an agenda, right? And we got to make sure everything on the agenda was talked about within the 30 minutes or within the hour of the meeting. And we don't make space for this type of communication. That, I think, is making sure that equity is in spaces, even in this conversation that we're having, right? We shouldn't feel like we have to apologize for being storytellers. How do we normalize that? Can we be succinct? Absolutely.
Mm-hmm.
Right? Can we have our, what they call it, elevator speech? Absolutely. We know when to do that. And we know when storytelling is of value. So I think showing up in that way as leaders in state government can also help to not necessarily shift the culture, but like sprinkle in new ways of communication.
I think all of those is kind of keep all of us going.
Mm-hmm.
I think every day, because you cannot be angry all the time and not feeling hopeful. And it has to have some things that I think, for me personally, I have to kind of attach myself. Not like, maybe attach, not the right word. And here you go again, like, you know, my vocabulary. It's like, need to really being able to get close to some things that really help to motivate and really help to inspire, empower us to keep going.
Mm-hmm.
Because otherwise, being an advocate is tiring, it's exhausting, it's just so much, because you cannot really expect things to change overnight. But you cannot really give up, because you did talk about our ancestors and the people who's before us, people who still around us, the mentors, the leaders, the friends, all these people who's being around us, especially our ancestor who paved the way. And we still, you talk about this all the time, and you and I share this conversation multiple times, and how we walk on the shoulder of our ancestors and the sacrifice that they have made, our parents make for us. And now that for us is to look back, but then also to really value and appreciate what we have and pave that way.
I absolutely have the burden of being grateful that I am here in the United States of America and continuing to demonstrate that I am grateful. Is there a part of me that's angry about having to be grateful? Absolutely. Right? If we really want to be honest, we had nothing to do with the secret war in Laos. Did I want to be born in a refugee camp? I don't think any of us get a choice of, you know, where we want to be born. And then to be here in the United States and seeing the things that I was afforded, absolutely grateful. And then now that I've gotten a chance to see how decisions are being made and how this system in America was created for and by, and you could fill in the blank, that part makes me angry and optimistic. You can't sit in anger, so you make sure that you position yourself in partnership with whoever you need to, what system you need to make a difference, right? So the grateful and the anger opportunity, I think, go hand in hand. I think to sit here and just be fully grateful and not be truthful about there is pain that I sit with would be an injustice, right? Because again, when you look at the resettlement system and the non-system that exists for those who arrive seeking asylum, you see how so much can be done. When you think of the less than 1%, right, of the 100 million people who are displaced in the world that get resettled, no one's going to argue that they're not grateful. And then when you get here and you start to learn the system and you see inside and out how privilege shows up and how power shows up, it's hard to just sit still and not use platforms like this. Again, thank you to the Immigrant Story, you know, for even giving me this platform, right, to be able to speak my truth. I don't ever hope to be the voice for immigrant and refugee communities, because I'm not. Immigrants and refugees have their own voice. They're not voiceless. We just don't give them the platform and the opportunity to elevate their voice. So again, my job is to share my story, which is one of thousands and millions of other stories. I just happen to have the privilege to have this opportunity.
What are you looking forward to? What is this new opportunity ahead? What are things that you excited about?
In terms of like my current role and my responsibility and commitment in this office, I'm looking forward to hiring a team to, I don't want to use the word execute, but to really
implement,
but also like follow through with what our legislature and our community has asked for in the creation of this office. So I'm excited for the team. I'm also really, really looking forward to walking alongside our community partners. What I mean by that is our community-based organizations, our faith leaders, our refugee resettlement organizations, all the folks that have been a part of this office and elevating what the current needs are, and their ideas and suggestions of how we can better serve the community. Because if you look at the mandate of this office, right, we are supposed to identify, develop, and operate a statewide immigrant and refugee integration strategy. And we cannot do that alone. We have to do that in partnership. But I want to quote Welcoming Australia Chief Executive Officer Aleem Ali. I got the opportunity to hear him speak, and the words he said still, you know, echo for me. And he said, in order for us to walk alongside community, we first have to walk behind.
Mm. Well, thank you, Tak, for sharing the story and for being an inspiration, and really show that a true leader and
authentic leader, because you not just only talk about the system and policy, you being a part of the community and also being a part of this system and be that bridge. So thank you for everything that you do every day.
And what do we say in Khmer? Suk sabai.
No, not suk sabai. Okun.
Okun. Suk sabai is hello.
Suk sabai is how are you?
Okay.
Yeah, but okun, okun chara. And that's
okun chara.
Okun. Thank you so much.
Many Roads to Here is a production of The Immigrant Story. I produced and edited this episode with post-production by Greg Palmer. Our executive producer is the man with the plan, Sankar Raman. Thank you to St. Andrew Lutheran Church in Beaverton, Oregon, for letting us use their space to record. And a huge thank you to Talk and Saporn for the generosity of their time. This episode was funded by Anne Nato Campbell. For more stories, visit the Immigrant Story website, listen live at prp.fm, or stream us wherever you get your podcasts.